TFM.
Fun will now commence.
Welcome back, everyone, to The Journey, our dedicated Star Trek Voyager podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, I have to say, you look wonderful this morning. Not that you don't always look wonderful, but oh my.
Well, wow. thanks, Chris. I guess I really only have one question. Do we have any coffee? Because I could really, really use some coffee right now. And not that black sludge that you're trying to pretend is coffee. I want the real thing.
Okay, well, I have some better than coffee substitute for you. It's the second batch. I've tweaked the recipe. You can try it again if you want. I've also got these little snacks on the side. Kes helped me make them. I just want to tell you, don't eat any of the little pink things and you'll be fine.
Okay, I don't think you're hearing me, Chris. I want all the coffee you have. Like Ron Swanson wanting all the eggs and bacon, I want all the coffee you have. Actual coffee.
All right, well, for that, I think we're going to have to go into that nebula right over there.
Oh, great.
And see what we can find. I'm sure nothing bad will happen to us in there.
Yeah. Which now that you mentioned, you know, this cloud, I've been thinking, you know, I've been looking at clouds from both sides now, and from up and down, and still somehow it's clouds illusions. I recall, I don't really know clouds at all. I feel like that applies to this nebula cloud thing we're looking at.
I don't know. I'm very cloudy about the whole thing myself. So why don't we discuss it and find
it's
out?
It's like we're looking through a mirror darkly, okay?
Through a cloud darkly. Yes, everyone. We're going to continue our 30th anniversary Star Trek Voyager rewatch today with the fifth episode of season one. It's The Cloud. And here's a quick rundown. Several weeks into their journey home, both Janeway and Voyager find their energy reserves depleted. For the captain, a simple trip to what used to be her private dining room for a cup of Neelix is even better than coffee's substitute might be all that's needed. For the ship, however, a trip into a mysterious nebula is required. Voyager is hungry for Omicron particles, and there seems to be a rich supply just ahead. But this cloud is not what it seems, and Janeway may need to turn to her animal guide to save the crew. So, Matthew, once again, we have encountered something unusual in space, and we're going to make a pit stop and check it out. But at least this time, they do justify it with a line of dialogue about maybe being able to use these particles to create like an antimatter reserve.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is an episode, at least, that gives us a very good justification for what we're about to do. And, you know, I'm glad that you brought this up, because I wanted to ask you, obviously, with being in the Alpha and Beta quadrants, even in the Gamma quadrant, right, with Deep Space Nine, we don't talk a lot about Starfleet ships and really the way they're powered other than matter and antimatter, and the need for any kind of fuel and the idea of power reserves and all that kind of stuff. We very rarely talk about this type of thing in Star Trek. And yet, of course, here in Voyager, and especially in this episode, it becomes a running theme. And so my question to you is, does it feel like it would have been helpful for one of these episodes to kind of clearly define the parameters of the power situation so that we could have an understanding then as we're moving forward? And the reason I ask that is obviously you kind of think of what Ronald D. Moore does with the reboot of Battlestar Galactica and that first season, you know, I think the first episode is water, where they've got to find water. right? Because yeah.
Well, the first episode is 33.
Or 33,
but,
you're
yeah,
right.
Yeah, but then, yeah, I know what you mean.
And then I
yeah.
think the next one's water. And, mm-hmm. and so you have this running theme of the things that are needed to keep this fleet going. Mm-hmm. And Voyager, in many senses, in this first season, starts to stumble into this idea, okay, what are the ways in which we can kind of make this series stand apart from the other series, right? Mm-hmm. We're so used in the 24th century. We have everything at our fingertips with replicators and all that kind of stuff. Okay, how can we make this show feel different? And of course, one of the ways they decide to do that is to conserve power, and therefore you can't just go to the replicator whenever you want something. Mm-hmm. And yet, because we've never truly really discussed this in Star Trek, it does feel like to me it would have been nice to have had one of these early episodes kind of talk about the idea, okay, it's going to take us 75 years to get home. But mm-hmm. what does that mean then for this ship, the type of ship it is? I mean, we know Voyager, just, I guess, probably more through meta knowledge than anything else. It's a more short range scientific vessel. That's what mm-hmm. it's made for. It's not made for long voyages like an Enterprise D galaxy class mm-hmm. starship. And so, because of that, it feels like it almost would have been nice to kind of had some of that laid out for us a little bit in one of these first episodes. So we do kind of have, and then you've already built expectation of what some of the storylines can be for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting question. My first thought is that if I were writing the style of stories that we get in Star Trek, and I knew I'm probably going to be writing 7 years of 26 stories per season, I might not want to put too much structure in place early on where I restrict myself from telling certain kinds of stories later on because I've established something sure. hard and fast about how the ship mm-hmm. works. And
yeah, that makes sense.
Like, I think a story like Battlestar Galactica, it works really well because the lack of resources drives so much of, they're on the run all the time. You know, they're not lost. Of course, they are searching for the mythical Earth, but they're on the run and right. they've got to find a way just to stay alive more so than actually get to a clear destination like Voyager is. But at the same time here, in this situation, and because they're making so many pit stops, it would be nice to have a clearer understanding of what their needs are so that the needs mm-hmm. aren't just popping yeah. up here and there randomly yeah. as the story requires it. And right. it would also be nice to have more than just one line of dialogue to justify mm-hmm.
yeah.
making a potentially risky pit stop like this.
Yeah. Well, because when you talk about like power issues, I think, you know, we all, again, we have this understanding of the things that Starfleet ships run on, which is the dilithium crystals, which are regulating the warp drive interaction mm-hmm. between matter and antimatter. We know something a little bit about like the idea of needing deuterium. But other than that, like unless you've, you know, read the Starfleet tech manual that came out for the Enterprise D mm-hmm. back in those days, you probably don't have a really good sense of when they're saying they're conserving power. But why? Because really, our sense in Star Trek is almost that it's a perpetuation of power, like mm-hmm. that it almost never ends. And so to say, oh, we need to conserve it just, I'm not necessarily saying you have to lay out everything, but even just saying that, it's like, okay, what exactly are we trying to conserve in the power system that can run out in this system?
Yeah,
so we
right.
have an idea
yeah.
of like what that is. Those are the small little details, I think, that would just make it feel real, right? It makes mm-hmm. The tangible sense of like, oh, this thing could run out and then mm-hmm. we are really in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Do you think if the show were written today, that might be in there a little bit more? Just the way of telling science fiction stories on television has changed a bit since the time that Voyager was written?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I do mm-hmm. actually think we probably would have gotten a little bit more of that. And part of that is that, you know, when you think of television today and the way it's written, you know, you tend to have much more cohesive seasons, right? Mm-hmm. Even the Strange New Worlds, right? You have standalone episodes, but those episodes are all meant to kind of build into a greater whole. And we've seen that play out in mm-hmm. those, especially like with the Gorn story there, like that's been kind of simmering in the background. And then it's finally come to fruition in this the end of the second season, where we're all eagerly awaiting the third season to see how that turns out. So you do get this sense that, especially with this, right, you would have, I think, had to really, you would have expected the writers to sit down and really nail down, like when in the series Bible specifically, okay, what are some of the major hiccups, hangups for this crew when it comes to the problems they're going to face in mm-hmm. the sense of just, if we could go straight home, 75 years, right? Ship alone, what are the things that can fall apart, that could easily run out, you know, all that type of stuff. They would have had to, I think, figure that out more. And so that is one of the things that makes then this story, you know, there is a realism to it in the sense of, oh, we can't just do whatever we want now because we're alone and we have to conserve power. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you also get this sense in the show where you're like, it doesn't seem like it that big a deal. You know, it's like, it's mm-hmm. a big deal, but it's also not a big deal. And so, yeah, I think it probably would have felt just more realistic
yeah.
on a show today and made a little bit more sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Now, I will say that my memory of watching Voyager in first run is that I didn't think about this kind of stuff very much when I was watching the stories. I was just kind of following Star Trek as it went along, and the style of the stories fit well into what mm-hmm. I was familiar sure. with, and so I didn't think about it as much. Well, why don't we shift from that, because it connects then, and that kind of thing, if you're going to focus on your characters, is a little bit less important, because we don't need to talk about the inner workings of the how the ship operates so much in a story about the characters and how they come together as a family.
Sure.
And in this episode, that's what they end up focusing on, is the need, Janeway's realization that in this situation, she's going to have to get closer to the crew. The crew's going to have to become more of a family. She's not quite sure how to do that.
Yeah.
We see in like cases like Tom and Harry, they're also not quite sure how to bridge that gap because they're mm-hmm. accustomed to the captain being
right.
kind of separated.
Yeah.
And that's what this story ends up largely being about. Mm-hmm. And
yeah,
that'll tie into another thing we'll talk about a little bit later, which is Chakotay's role in helping Janeway figure all that out. But it's in terms of how this story starts to build some cohesion within the series of their situation, the smaller ship, like we've been talking about, and becoming a family. How did you feel about this episode?
I mean, that's one of the things that I think the episode does really well. You know, Janeway realizing that their situation is going to call for something different is really interesting. So in some ways, you know, my wife and I have been watching through seasons of The Next Generation. We just finished season 2. And then, of course, you know, we finished our rewatch of season 1 of Deep Space Nine, and now we're in season 2 of that. And there's a real interesting dichotomy between the way in which Sisko is a commander mm-hmm. and his relationship with his crew and the way Picard is, right?
Yeah.
There are only two people on the ship, really, that Picard, I think, lowers his guard with a lot, which are, in the first couple of seasons, it's Riker mm-hmm. and it's Troy. And mm-hmm. part of that is because Crusher leaves the show, and so they kind of take that away from him in some ways. So mm-hmm. it's really those two characters, mostly, that get the kind of more in-depth with the character and seem to have an actual relationship with him. You know, we do it every once in a while with, like, you know, Wesley or something when they go on that trip together in season two. Picard has to have surgery and all. And then there's that moment with them where they bond. But whereas, you know, I'm just really struck by when we were talking about, you know, the second season here of Deep Space Nine, and you've got Sisko seems so much closer with his crew. And part of that is because in the way in which they live together, right? You know,
yeah, it's a community more than exactly. It's not a starship. So,
and
yeah.
So what's interesting then in this episode is that Janeway in many ways is kind of realizing that the type of captain that she would have known somebody like Picard to be is not the type of captain that she's going to be able to be in a voyage like this where they are alone and she has nobody else to interact with. But also, because of the nature of this, they are going to become incredibly close. And so therefore, letting down some of that guard and allowing herself to be an actual person to these people who are probably going to need her more as a person. She even mentions we don't have a counselor on board, right? And so, therefore, she is going to have to play more roles than she might have needed to previously. And so I really like this idea of you know, Janeway kind of sensing that there are going to have to be some barriers that she, you know, she's going to have to lower some shields with herself and allow herself the opportunity to feel that community just as her people, her crew need that community. Because if she doesn't, she is probably going to suffer the ill effects, you know, when you think of psychologically. We need each other, you know, we're made for a relationship and she needs that relationship just as much as they do. And so I think this is an incredibly smart thing for the writers to tap into. And, you know, of course, in this episode, it lends to also some serious fun happening by the end of the episode.
Yeah. Well, lowering her shields would be a great way to conserve power, right? Keep the shields.
Yes, going. Exactly. Exactly.
But yeah, it's the case where, you know, I said the station is a community, it's not a starship. And then here we have a starship, but because of what's happened to them, they have to become a community. So it's set up well to kind of evolve this element of the overall story of Voyager. And it's also set up well in that Voyager being a much smaller ship, being the science vessel, probably initially is so that when they're thrown across the galaxy, they're gonna be put in a situation where it makes it more difficult for them, as we've talked about before, you know, to get home. But the other thing that it does by having it be such a small ship, that, you know, the comment she makes about not having a counselor, it makes perfect sense, right? This ship is... It just
they were supposed to be there on Tuesday.
So. Yeah, right. The counselor missed the flight. But
let's just slight tidbit. We only have 64, I believe, photon torpedoes. So keep count,
I
guys.
Know. Is it 64 that she says in this episode?
I believe that the number is something like that. So it's not a high number.
No, it's not, and they end up using well over 80, I think, by the end of the series. That's a running joke. Actually, she says they have 38, so it's even
38. There you
even
go.
Fewer than you're thinking.
Okay, well,
but that's like a running joke that I'm sure that Tristan and Char used to joke about it here on podcast years ago, and we always did on the Ready Room when we did Voyager episodes.
Yep.
And fans do in general, right? I think there are videos on YouTube of every torpedo shot where they're counting down into the negatives, you know, of stock.
I can't remember, but somebody did a video like that, and it's like, how many torpedoes do they shoot? I don't know. We could look it up, but it's funny.
I don't remember the exact number, but I know it's over 80. But But that ties in, actually, though, to the question you asked me at the beginning of the discussion about putting hard, fast technical parameters around the ship and how it impacts your storytelling. And this is a case where, without thinking, they just pulled a random number out of the hat and said, oh, we've only got 38 photon torpedoes, without thinking about what that would mean later on. And what's worse is not pulling out a random number, but then also establishing that we don't have any way to replenish them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, yeah. I've always gotten around to this. We're way down the rabbit hole here from this story, but I've always gotten around this whole joke about torpedoes in Voyager with, just because they say they don't have a way to replenish them doesn't mean they can't figure out a way to do it later on. So I just always assume that they found a way to make some more. But it is a case of, you have to be careful when you establish something like this.
By the way, I found the answer, Chris. 96 okay. Torpedoes were fired.
Oh, they fired 96 altogether. Yep. All right. So,
which, fighting the Borg seems low anyway.
Yeah, true, right? Yeah. Well, they were conserving them. They're all about conservation and sustainability on Voyager.
Maybe they
Voyager,
just,
Matthew.
You know, found some later, or, you know, Seven was able to help them make more. You know, she's Borg. It's fine.
She was roaming around the ship in one of the lower decks, and she found like a room that no one ever had gone into before.
Exactly.
And it just happened
Guys,
to have a
these
bunch
are the extra
of torpedoes. They're all stacked.
Yeah,
they're
exactly.
kind of dusty because no one had been in there.
Anyway, yeah, I'm sorry. I've totally okay. derailed this. This is so, my fault.
Let's reel ourselves back into the family situation. But
we are family. I got all my sisters with me. Sorry.
All the Delaney sisters.
The Delaney sisters with me.
All right. So I don't even quite remember where we were, but we were talking about family anyway. And the fact that the ship is so small, I think, is where I was. And it sets,
yes, yes.
It sets this up really well.
Agreed.
For them to have to become a community. And so we often talk about how in The Next Generation, the characters do not develop very much over the course of seven seasons. Whereas mm-hmm. on Deep Space Nine, we get this rich character development. And the way they set this up here, I think they gave themselves a pretty good situation to be able to evolve characters much more so than The Next Generation did, while still telling TNG-style stories, which was one of their goals.
Yeah, I know. I mean, that's exactly what they are trying to do in this sense. And you can clearly see that with the conversations that, you know, like Tom and Harry are having, and you get this backstory for, you know, Harry Kim and why he wears the mask to sleep. And, you know, we get a lot of backstory here for the character. I mean, if anybody in Voyager has a rich backstory by the end of the show, it's going to be Tom Paris. And that's because we continually are digging into him as a character and what mm-hmm. makes him tick. And this episode does that. And then, of course, the episode does the same thing in some ways for Chakotay and starting to explain his cultural heritage as a Native American. Mm-hmm. Although I don't know if we can really even he's Native because he's not American. And so he's I don't know what we call him.
Well, his people were originally.
Yes, but now they're not. I mean, they are on a whole other planet.
Of course, we know from the Next Generation about how Native Americans had been relocated and.
Yeah.
So forth.
So, anyway, that's
space,
a whole other subject. But yeah.
Well, while we're talking about Chakotay, though, that is one thing I did want to talk about is, and this is something that the writers have talked about as well, their approach to his character. I thought it was a good idea and an interesting idea to have a Native American character on the show, because Star Trek has always been about creating.
Sure.
Crews with some diversity. And this was an area that they hadn't really explored very much, except for the little bit in The Next Generation. But it's such a, it's a difficult culture to explore, I think, in an American television show.
Sure.
Without becoming cliche, without offending people. You want to do it well, but it's a touchy topic. And I'm not sure that the way that they actually present Chakotay explores Native American culture in the way they were hoping to on the show, because they're like, walking the fine line. They're dancing around, and they and what did you think about the characterization? This is the first time that we really get much about it, actually.
Well, one, I got to make this comment, but he says Hakuna, and all I could think was Matata. What a wonderful
Hakuna
phrase.
Matata. What a wonderful phrase.
It means no worries for the rest of your days. You know, yeah, it's that problem-free
no
philosophy.
Craze, Matthew.
So anyway, I had to say it. But no, I like that you brought this up because, again, this is a place where I think their thought process is really interesting. And yet, even in this episode, the expression of that and the execution of that feels so kind of cliched and generic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that could be a frustration for anyone who is of that heritage. You know, it almost feels like it would have been much more interesting for them to have chosen a specific tribe to focus on that he's from, that his mm-hmm. people have a lineage
which we do
from.
Get eventually, but right now we don't know.
Right. Yeah. And so, again, it's not bad, but it just does feel very Hollywoodized, right? You know, where we don't want to be specific, and in that lack of specificity, it feels kind of trite and patronizing instead of actually real. Mm-hmm. And that's a little bit of a frustration then, because the desire for Chakotay in this is to be able to equip his captain with something akin to a counselor, which she doesn't have access mm-hmm. to go to, say like Picard, who could go to Troy and talk about anything with her, and everything is mm-hmm. confidential. Nothing is going to leave that room. And even though Janeway has Chakotay to be able to talk to, right, she's also having to think about the idea that she's the superior in the relationship mm-hmm. then. And so there's always a kind of a barrier and a line there. And so I think the idea is incredibly interesting, right? And it does add something to Chakotay in the sense that, you know, Deep Space Nine at this point has been discussing this idea of kind of religious practices, obviously mm-hmm. with the Bajorans, and then even as we further explore Sisko. And so to have a character in Starfleet then, like Chakotay, even though he was part of the Maquis, part of Starfleet mm-hmm. now, be a kind of a man of faith and religion in some senses, right? Spirituality mm-hmm. is an interesting thing for them to try and discuss. But I will say, just especially in this episode, it does come off. I mean, it's fine, it doesn't really hit any buttons. And it also kind of just feels very interestingly strange for the ultra scientist that we know already for the first few episodes that Janeway is to mm-hmm. be ready to just kind of dive into this. It feels like this should be kind of almost like a longer story for them to kind of grow together and discuss, you know, than her just immediately being like, yeah, I want to do that. You know, like mm-hmm. it doesn't necessarily mm-hmm. feel like maybe the most true version of the character mm-hmm. even by this point.
Sure. Yeah. Well, first off, to the Janeway point, it's true. I would expect her to be more skeptical of this, just given how they've established her character. I guess I could accept it in that she realizes she really has to be open to something different because the way that she normally approaches things isn't working and it's not going to work. And also, maybe she's opening up to Chakotay a little bit more. Like, he's obviously coming to her offering something that means mm-hmm. something to him. And so she's willing, she can set the science part aside and she can listen to him and open up to him. As far as Chakotay goes himself, like the Native American presentation, it feels to me a bit like, I was thinking, I know we got so many songs in here. You know the story of Toto's Africa, right? The story, the lyrics of Africa are essentially someone who is writing about Africa, but they've never been to Africa. Mm-hmm, and they just know about Africa from reading travel guides, essentially. So they bless the rains down in Africa. And this feels a little bit like basing the elements of the story on something that you've heard about Native American culture in a very general sense. And then presenting that. And so I think that's one reason why it feels kind of hollow and cliche. Whereas what I would have done if I were writing it and if I were producing the show is, if I'm going to go down this path and I'm going to have a Native American character on the show like this, you know, I would actually hire some Native Americans as consultants to really learn about, like you said earlier, it would be helpful, I think, to pick one tribe to focus on, because having his identity right now anyway be generic Native American, you know, cultures are different. It's like generic human. Depending on where you grow up on this planet, your culture is going to be quite different. And so that's what I would have done. Like I would have picked one culture, one tribe to focus on, and I would have gotten consultants and like, let's make this real. Like let's not be scared to present a culture, because, you know, it's a topic that has historically been a touchy one in the U.S. to talk about. So
yep, agree.
Yeah, that's just, I can understand why they do it the way they do it here, but I think that they're missing a huge opportunity in the writing and a huge opportunity to explore a real world culture that gets overlooked a lot. And the story could have been a whole lot stronger, not just in this episode, but all the way through. You know, Chakotay's a character that I kind of feel as a character, he gets a little bit lost as the series goes, but I think this aspect of his character definitely kind of falls by the wayside as we go on, because they seem scared to really make this the core of who he is, even though that's how he's set up.
Well, and I mean, this is one of the beauties of what they do on Deep Space Nine, right? They create a religious experience for the characters in a religion that is not human, and therefore then you quote unquote can't offend anybody. And I think you know, that is kind of the frustrating thing is that it would be incredibly interesting to see Chakotay be this man of faith and spirituality, who truly believes this stuff, who follows these things, who it has an impact on his life, the same way that we end up seeing with the Bajorans and then somebody like Sisko, and allow that to speak to characters, because we know that there are a lot of, you know, specifically Earth religions that do still continue into this time period. And so it would have been nice to be able to see that. And so it's one of those things where as we're here at the beginning of Voyager, there are some really good ideas in this show. Them being lost, Janeway having to become more part of the crew than you would normally get with a captain. This crew kind of becoming more like an extended family than just a Starfleet crew. The struggles they're going to face with having to not necessarily rely on Starfleet technology, but more on some of the classic things that have made species be able to survive, like cultivation and harvest of hydroponic bays, those type of things. I mean, that's all great stuff. And interpersonal relationships that can then form on this ship where, you know, people are going to pair off, you know, not just with the Delaney sisters or holograms, but with actual people. And then the idea of being able to have this, which is an incredibly important part of people's lives, right? Which is faith. And to have that play out. All of these are great ideas. And so what's going to be fascinating then, you know, just as we're walking through the series again, really is to see, okay, so how do they live up to the promise that those type of things are given, you know, that's all the stuff that's been given to us here at the beginning of the show. Now, how does that play out with the rest of the seasons? And does it kind of live up to that promise, or do they find themselves in places where, okay, we started with this idea, but we don't really know, either know how to utilize it, or, as you kind of mentioned, it almost feels like we're afraid to utilize it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let's shift gears a little bit and talk about your favorite character on the show, Neelix. I mean, I know, I see in the background there, hanging up on the wall, you've got your Neelix chef's hat and apron. I know that you like to cook some stuff up often in your
kitchen. Thank you for not mentioning the picture of Neelix in the bathtub. Appreciate that. So.
But what I want to mention here actually ties into what we have been talking about in previous episodes and also in this one a little bit, which is stopping to explore something over and over. And here they at least justify, like, maybe we can use the Omicron particles as an antimatter mm-hmm. reserve
right.
or to create an antimatter reserve. But what Neelix says in the episode, it feels like, it almost feels like the writers know that this is what viewers are thinking. Like, why are you stopping all the time? Because Neelix tells Kes, these people are natural born idiots, if you ask me. They just keep stopping, getting in danger. They don't need to do this. But in contrast to that, I found it interesting what they're doing with Kes's character as they try to evolve her character. She has this kind of wide-eyed wonder that sums up Starfleet and mm-hmm. the people who join right. it. You know, Neelix can't understand that Starfleet officers, they have to explore. That's what drives their very existence. Mm-hmm. That's why they're in Starfleet for right. the most part. And Kes tells Neelix, if I were captain, I'd open every crack in the universe and peek inside, just like Captain Janeway does. So in this exchange, we've really got like this tug of war of two ways of looking at not only what Janeway and the crew are doing in universe here, but also how viewers are seeing the show.
Well, what I find interesting about this is that Neelix is a poor man's Quark, in the sense yeah. of that he is the one.
I'll say so at this point anyway. Yeah. I don't know if yeah. I agree how he evolves, but right now right. it feels yeah, like
yes.
we've got to replace Quark. How are we going to do it?
Yeah. yeah. And in that, you know, his commentary is meant to feel like Quark's commentary as he's discussing things with Odo, who they mm-hmm. both have these interesting perceptions of, especially of the Starfleet and the human crew members. And mm-hmm. so, and I understand then what they are trying to do with Neelix. The way they are going about it is not great.
Mm-hmm.
It's, I'm sorry to anybody who likes Neelix, but right now the character is just really obnoxious, and it feels like they have him running around being very over the top all of the time. And that's the difference between him and Quark, right? Quark, I think the way Armin Shimmerman portrays that character, everything he does just feels very natural to mm-hmm. him and the character. And with Neelix, it's just they haven't found a way to make us like the character enough mm-hmm. for him to be this annoying at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really the juxtaposition that they have put themselves in. And so, yeah, I mean, when, you know, he just names himself the morale officer and then he brings food to the bridge. I mean, it's just like, okay, the what's happening in that scene is just so childish. And like, hey, everybody look at me. And like, everything is about Neelix. And again, that's kind of an interesting thing, because in many ways, it's just a Quark type character. And yet that's not what Quark does, right? Like mm-hmm. he's not annoying in that same sense. And so, yeah, they're still struggling, I think, to kind of figure out how to integrate this character within the rest of the crew and the show itself.
Yeah.
And I will say, I don't think that they've found it at all yet, especially in this episode.
Well, a big difference between Quark and Neelix is that, first of all, Quark had already established his life on the station before Starfleet got there. So he has his own world.
Yes.
And even after Starfleet has arrived, you know, Quark has his own little corner of the station that's his, and he has his own life, and he's always got some kind of deal going on. Something's happening, but he has his own focus, and it doesn't really matter if the rest of the, if the Starfleet people are around or not, right? Quark is Quark, and he's got his own thing going. Whereas Neelix is like, if you had a house guest, if someone asked, can I come, you know, crash on your couch for a week? And did you find them like all day, every day? They're like roaming around your house, getting into stuff.
Yeah. Just imagine your Uncle Sal came to stay for like 7 years.
7 years. Right. But right now it's only been a few weeks, Matthew, since Caretaker. Yep. It feels like 7 years for the crew.
Yeah, right? It already does feel like 7 years. I'm sorry, my friends. It is.
Yeah. Because it is like, I mean, imagine your uncle sleeping on your sofa tonight. Tomorrow you go upstairs and like he's turned your bathroom into a barbecue pit or something like that.
Like, why have you put a Hawaiian barbecue pit in my bathroom?
Exactly. So they're very different characters. They're very different situations. Yeah. Yeah. But at the heart of it, yes, it is like he's supposed to be playing the same role in the story that Quark plays in the DS9 story.
Yeah. I really like the way Janeway deals with him, because I would have dealt with him the exact same way. Get out.
Get out. I think it comes across as annoying to the viewer, to many viewers, because there's such a disconnect between him and the Starfleet crew and what they're doing and what they're dealing with and how they approach things. And to put a positive spin on it, I will say that the things that he does perhaps pushes the crew and pushes Janeway's decision-making in directions where it needs to go, but it wouldn't go, and it certainly wouldn't go quickly if there wasn't someone like him around to just stir things up and just force them to look at situations differently.
I mean, that is definitely a part of the show, and it definitely happens. And, you know, I think the character, they find a little bit more balance with the character, of course, as they move forward. You know, I think just, you know, at this moment for myself personally, as I'm rewatching the show, it is one of the things to which I'm constantly frustrated by in many ways, because it's just what they're trying to do at this point for me is not working at the moment. And so, whereas, you know, as we mentioned, there's a lot of other stuff in here that is working for me so far, at least in this episode and some of the ideas they have, which, you know, one of the ideas that we get here, and it, of course, is incredibly Star Trek, which is this idea of that through the exploration process, we actually run into a life form we didn't know was a life form, and we've actually, you know, hurt somebody. And, you know, I think that that is an incredibly interesting idea. And the way in which then they look to solve this problem and to live up to their ideals, even though they are so far from home, I think is obviously a hallmark to them as characters, and I like that. I think it's it works for the show, and it also shows that, you know, these characters are not going to just discount who they are and what they believe in at this point just because they're in a position where, you know, I mean, for all intents and purposes, right, they could have taken advantage of this creature and taken the power that they needed from it, and they don't do that. And, mm-hmm. you know, I think that's one of the things that just does really help with the episode here. And it, you know, comes down to being a very Star Trek-y type of episode in that sense. And so I like that. I think they do a pretty good job about that.
Well, that really reminds me of The Devil in the Dark from the original series, because you've got the Horda. And I may have mentioned this on a recent episode of something that we were discussing, actually, but that was a life form that was just so different that they couldn't recognize at first that it was a life form. But once they realized that they could be harming it, they choose not to. And that's mirrored here with the concept of this cloud. And I think that that's really, it's a classic Star Trek element. And it's that part of Star Trek that we get from time to time that really hits at just the very core of Gene Roddenberry's concept of we're going to seek out new life forms, we're going to learn about them, and we're going to try to coexist with them and not harm them.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I like that part of the story. It's also interesting that this story started with that, just the idea of there's this cloud and it's a life form that we don't recognize, and there wasn't enough there, obviously, to tell an entire story from just that, which forced Michael Piller into shifting toward all the character development that we've been talking about today, which, I mean, it seems like an obvious thing in the first place that let's focus on characters when we're telling stories, but that doesn't always happen in Star Trek. And here, you know, ultimately, I think they did a good job of taking the sci-fi idea of the cloud as a life form, doing what they should do, which is focus on the characters, but then blending those together so that that idea, which is very core to Star Trek, actually just, it does drive the character development. And we actually do get evolution through the episode for the crew and where the story is going to go.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think they do a great job in that. And it does make for an interesting episode. And I like what you just called out, you know, in the sense that it does feel very much like Devil in the Dark, because this is a life form to which, you know, nobody would have expected to be in the way in which they find it. And so, that I think that's really fascinating. And again, it's an incredibly Star Trek thing. No, I like that. I think they did a great job in that.
So one last thing to touch on that they introduce here, I wanted to get your thoughts on, is Sandrine's, the pool hall, the bar in France. They're searching right now, trying to figure out where can the crew go hang out.
Yeah.
We talked about on a previous episode, Neelix creating the mess hall. And that being a place that can be like 10 forward where they can, the crew can go and interact and hang out. And so what can they create that's a place for downtime that's maybe a little bit more like Quark's, I guess, where, you know, there are games going on. It's not just a place to sit down. It's not a fancy restaurant in a 5-star hotel like 10 forward. And they come up with this idea of Sandrine's. They have this pool hall here. I know that they were trying to recapture the magic of the poker games in the Next Generation. And what's something else that people get together and do? Well, they shoot pool. So how about let's have a pool hall? And then this ties in with Tom. It's kind of one of his creations. But do you like this place? Do you feel like it works?
I mean, I think it's fine. You know, I think one of the interesting parts of this is that it definitely, I think the thing about this is it just reflects Tom's character, right? Really what's most interesting about this is how much we learn about Tom Paris by being in this place. You know, he is clearly somebody who, he has a very specific sense of being and a mm-hmm. persona. And that comes across in this place where it's full of people who are very sure of themselves. Mm-hmm. Also, I would say probably, very sexually active. And very surface level. And that's Tom Paris right now in a nutshell. And I think that's what makes Sandrine's the most interesting. You know, one of the interesting things about Voyager we'll see as we move forward is they're going to spend a lot of time trying to find a place that works for them. I was always actually, I was talking to a listener there on the Babel conference today, actually, about this idea of, I was always actually pretty surprised that they never, and that they didn't kind of create the mess hall in a place that felt more like 10 forward, because there are places on the ship itself of Voyager where there are some forward-facing windows, especially like on the underside of the saucer, which could have been that type of spot, which I think, you know, you could have done that. And then
they could have called it down under.
Yeah, that would have been great. I love it. But yeah, I mean, I think Sandrine's is fine. But to me, the problem with it is that it reflects more of Tom than it does just kind of this place that feels more comfortable, I think, for all of the characters to hang out in.
Yeah, yeah. I think some of his crewmates might be uncomfortable in there, right?
I mean, you know, interesting thing, though, Janeway's just fine because she racks them up and takes them down, so...
And Kate Mulgrew has said that when that eight ball sinks, that she's actually the one who did the shot. She knocked it in. They worked on her pool game some before.
I mean, she's
when
great.
They were preparing to shoot. Yeah,
I think it's fantastic. That whole scene with her is really wonderful. Mm-hmm. And it does give her that moment to really be the captain who is willing to give this a try, where I play with my crew. And gosh, does she just really change in the sense that, like, she really lets loose in this episode at the end. And I love it. I think it's actually kind of great. And so,
yeah. Well, being willing to give it a try, and it goes back to the situation with Chakotay and her being open to his medicine bundle and finding an animal guide and all. Like, she's opening up to new things.
Yes, yes. And so, no, I don't know. What did you feel about Sandrine's?
I mean, I think it's fine. You know, it's... I remember the first time when it aired, it felt natural for Star Trek. You know, they're always creating these places where they can go. I would say that if you're concerned about conserving energy and power, which we've talked about, maybe doing what you suggested, pick an area on a deck, like under the saucer with a nice view out the windows, and replicate or build some actual pool tables and create a bar. Yeah. And like, you could actually make a physical environment that's very similar to this, that's just always there instead of having to use energy. And of course, Voyager's got this whole thing about how, well, the holodeck uses different energy source from the rest of the ship, so we can keep them running as much as we want.
Yeah, but, which they take all the way to Star Trek Picard. So, you know.
That's convenient for storytelling. But
yeah.
No, it was okay. It's fine. I like how it's going to be used in an upcoming episode when it starts to get twisted around. I think the pool table metaphor works well there.
Yeah. In the end, it's fine. Yeah. It doesn't create, I mean, one of the things that Voyager will try to do is to do this. And it's fascinating to me that, you know, you get Deep Space Nine, and the moment that they bring in Vix, it's like, it just somehow fits, you know? And Voyager doesn't really ever seem to necessarily find that when it comes to the holodeck. But that's a discussion for another time.
Yeah. I do find it interesting, though, as you were mentioning, so much about the atmosphere of Sandrine's comes from Tom's character. And yet, Robbie Duncan McNeil, who plays Tom Paris, actually wasn't very fond of the bar setting. He has said that it didn't feel right. It didn't feel like the right atmosphere for them to have a bar it was kind of too dark and moody, and it didn't have enough fun to it. So
interesting. Yeah. Which we'll get when we get to places like Captain Proton. So, you know.
Yeah, they finally, eventually they hit on some really fun stuff for sure. All right. Well, what are your final thoughts on this one? And what's your rating for the Cloud?
Yeah, I mean, this is, I think, a decent episode. And there are some good things that I like about it. And there's some things that are frustrating about it. I think this is probably a good 3.5 out of 5 Cloud residues stuck to the hole. because, yeah, in the end, it's not an amazing episode, but I do like a lot of the things that they're attempting.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it's successful, I think, just with the character development and all of that. And I like that they're looking to go in different directions. So, yeah, 3.5 out of 5. What about you, Chris?
Yeah, I enjoy it. I mean, it's kind of a typical Star Trek episode at the time that it aired. You know, you felt like, well, it's another week. We're getting another episode of Star Trek. Like we discussed, I like that there are some very core Star Trek elements to it. The TOS callback with a life form that we don't understand. I like the Doctor in here. We didn't talk about him today, but watching it again now, continuing what I mentioned in a previous episode about viewing the Doctor through the eyes of modern AI and large language models, there's the comment in here, the idea in here about the Doctor being able to program himself, a hologram being able to program itself. And as we live in a world now,
because he's going to give himself a family and go to war. And
yeah, none of that stuff will ever happen on the show.
No.
Actually, in hindsight, it is fun to hear him say that and then see later on how that stuff actually comes to be standalone stories. But yeah, I mean, we live in a world where computer code is starting to program itself. And so this is another case where they were far ahead in thinking about things that have come to our real world much faster than we could have anticipated. So that's an element of the story that I like as well. So I think, yeah, I'm going to give this one 6 cups of better than coffee substitute.
Janeway does not like your rating.
She does not. Yeah. She's, she won't even talk to me for the next week probably. But anyway, I'll get her some good Jamaican Blue Mountain. She'll be happy. Well, everyone, we would love to hear your thoughts on the Cloud. There are many ways for you to share those with us. Perhaps the best way is to go to the Babel Conference, which Matthew mentioned earlier. That is our group on Facebook. It's our listeners group. It's there to extend the conversations beyond the podcasts. So if you're joining for the first time, please do answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. You'll find a post on the timeline for this episode, and you can share your thoughts with Matthew and me and fellow listeners right there. You can also send us email, go to our website, trek.fm/contact, use the form there, choose to send to a show, and choose to the journey, and that will come to Matthew and me. And also you can find us in social media. Our username everywhere is TrekFM. And if your podcast app of choice allows you to leave a rating and a review, we'd love to get that from you as well. Now, Matthew, when you're not including Ricky in all your holo programs, where can people find you?
Yeah, honestly, she's not really my type. So you can find me all over social media under the name MattRushing02. You can also, of course, find me here on the network outside all the Star Trek talk in the 602 Club, where we are having a great time at a bar talking about all of those franchises we love outside of Star Trek. You can also find me over on the Nerd Party Network with 2 shows. One's called Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills, talking about Star Wars each and every week, as well as Owl Post, talking about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series. 1 chapter at a time. But Chris, when you're not hustling people at pool, where can people find you?
Yeah, that's my favorite side gig. You can find me in there doing that all the time. But when I'm not doing that, you can find me elsewhere on the network with you doing all those shows that you mentioned. You can also find me in many shows in the back catalog. So dig in there if you'd like to hear my thoughts on Star Trek across the board, pretty much every series and old episodes of Literary Treks as well. And if you'd like to chat about Star Trek or Japan or college football or anything else, you can find me on social media. My username everywhere is C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. And if you'd like to help us keep this rewatch and everything we're doing on the network going, we could definitely use your help. To find out how to support the network, please visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. We would not be here without your support. So thank you to everyone who is supporting us now. All right, Matthew. Well, I'm looking forward to next time where we'll try very hard to thread the eye of the needle.
Well, Chris, that sounds difficult. Hopefully we're not camels, but let's set course for home.